As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, corrupt. Standing by with our points and deductions about a big Premier League weekend. Everton Man United, with the Toffees beaten by overheads once again. Brentford Arsenal, with Kai no longer the limit. Newcastle against Chelsea, as remorseless as Edith Piaf, ahead of their trip to Paris. And Man City Liverpool, second last on Match of the Day. All that and more in this Totally Football Show. Sunday 26th of November, listener, hello to you. We've got Sasha Gurionov along for today's ride into football.
Hi, James.
Hi, Sasha. Charlie Eccleshare is fresh back from Spurs Villa.
Hello.
Hi, Charlie. And literally here in the studio is Daniel Story.
Lovely to be here, James.
Well, it's so nice to see you, Daniel. What's brought you in?
Also Spurs Villa, which I thought might be the most chaotic game of the season. And it wasn't miles off that, I don't think. It was an odd beast of a football match.
Yeah. It could have been 2-2 after about 5 minutes. Duncan Alexander, best of me before, said there'd never been a 6-all in English top flight history. And I was thinking, could this be the day?
Yeah. Busy weekend, loads of chaos all over the place. Also Sunday morning, bringing news of the passing of Terry Venables, of course, at the age of 80. Hugely successful pass as a player, but I think it's as a manager that most of us will really have him as part of our footballing landscape. Daniel, you were tweeting about the fact that he's the manager who gave you the best summer of your childhood.
Yeah, I think those of us born almost the exact vintage as me, I was born in 1985, so I kind of missed out on Italia 90. Euro 92 didn't really feel a concept, and then USA 94 didn't have England in. So we were, I think, a very rare breed that we were almost 10 or 11 before we had that first big major tournament, and it happened to be in England, and it felt an iconic team. And yeah, and El Tel was... He wasn't the protagonist of it, but he felt like the ringleader, and he always felt, even as a kid, he always felt like this kind of magnanimous...
Avuncular.
Yeah, like Cockney.
He was that rarest of qualities, an England manager and then a former England manager that everybody liked.
Yeah.
He got out at the right time, didn't he?
Yeah, he
basically.
Did.
That was his last major job, or certainly major long-term job.
He did so much beyond that, and particularly the fact that he was an English manager who went to Barcelona... Won the title with them and came within a penalty shootout of winning the European Cup.
Yeah, he definitely, even at the time, I mean, I was very young, but and then that was my first major tournament watching Euro 96. And so it was, like so many people, it did just completely capture me. But even at the time, I remember him, he felt quite forward thinking. And obviously, you know, he'd come after the Graham Taylor era when England felt just like they'd regressed so much. And here was this guy who'd managed in Spain, played exciting football, but also winning football. And yeah, just so many nice memories. I was thinking today, that picture of him, which I would recommend seeking out, with Gareth Southgate after the penalty miss. And Venables just got this, like, that grin that he always had on his face. It just looks like the perfect person to be consoling someone in that moment.
Mm. So many other strings to his bow. Was he a feature of your life?
Yeah, he was a feature of my life, because for me, you know, Euro 96 came to Liverpool.
Right.
And Manchester. So
where were you at the time?
I was in Liverpool at the time.
Oh, yeah. Russia played, didn't they?
Russia played.
Was that the Italy game?
The Italy game.
I went to Casiraghi.
Yeah, the Casiraghi goal, the Timbala goal. at the same time, the England games were in the background. And, you know, Team England were never hugely popular in the Northwest. And I think at the time, I think I would say for Venables, he kind of represented this whole London-centric sense, I think, of it. But it wasn't, I don't think he provoked any ill feeling. But for me, I watched the shootout. And I remember the entire press room was in shock that England had managed to lose this game. But I do have the image of Venables consoling his players on the pitch. Right. And it's like sort of kind of the final thing for England.
I bet you got the image of England 4, Netherlands 1.
Yeah, and from a very selfish point of view, Stuart Pearce's penalty against Spain, obviously in the quarterfinals.
Brave man steps forward to take England's third. Banish the memory of Turin. Stuart Pearce. Oh yes, what a penalty!
There's a brilliant photo doing the rounds, which is not from that tournament, but it's of a 15-year-old Pep Guardiola looking up at Venables as he lifts the Spanish title.
Actually from the semi-final.
Oh, it's, sorry,
I think he's been lifted by his players.
Against Gothenburg. I hadn't appreciated until a few years ago just how well-respected he is abroad, how well-respected he is as a tactical innovator. People mentioning him in the same breath as Arrigo Sacchi and Johan Cruyff, which kind of blows my mind because I had no concept of that. I think probably because of the sheer kind of strength of his magnanimous personality and the kind of vuncularity to him makes you, it sort of gives the impression that he was a geezer, a man manager. Whereas actually it seems he was one of those very rare beasts of English managers that managed to combine both in the 90s.
Yeah.
I remember I was actually at that Spain penalty shootout game. It was a very, that was England's only penalty shootout win in a major tournament until the 2018 World Cup. But I was thinking something that slightly foreshadowed England losing that penalty shootout then against Germany. Not only did they lose to Steaua Bucharest, Barcelona on penalties, they missed all four of their penalties in that shootout, which feels like the kind of thing that nowadays would resurface either in the lead up to the shootout or the day after, being like, well, it's no, you know, Venables has got a penalty problem. This can't be a coincidence.
The inside story.
Exactly. The bad preparation, etc.
Terry, who was a multi-talented man. He had released records, multiple ones, in fact. He released a board game as well. Terry Venables invites you to be the manager. And also wrote crime novels.
Yes, he did.
About a maverick detective called Hazel.
I once had to sort of meet and greet with him at Cafe Football in London.
I remember that,
doesn't exist anymore.
Hasn't done for a while, I don't know.
But yeah, and he met 50 young kids who were, I'd say I was the most interested to meet him.
How old were you at the time, Dan?
I'd have been about 9.
Oh, wow. And what were you there for?
Well, I was there because I was there as a classic diner. Venables at that point was, his name was mud to me because of the 1991 FA Cup final. Okay. Obviously his Spurs had beaten Forest. And I think I probably said as much to him and he just sort of laughed and went, sorry about that, mate.
Well, on the subject of Terry Venables' tactical prowess, Michael Cox has a piece coming out this week on what Eltel's time as England manager represented tactically. You can find that on The Athletic. But in the meantime, Terry will be much missed, and our thoughts to his friends and family. Next up, let's get on to the results from Premier League Match Day 13. Saturday lunchtime, the weekend began with Man City's 1-1 draw against Liverpool, a result that ended City's run of consecutive home wins at 23 and allowed Arsenal to retake top spot thanks to their 1-0 win at Brentford later that day. Spurs, meanwhile, slipping out of the top four after their defeat at home to Villa. Elsewhere, Newcastle beat Chelsea 4-1. Brighton got their first win since September, 3-2 at Forest. While at the bottom, Luton got their first home win of this Premier League season, beating Palace 2-1. Bournemouth won again, 3-1 at Sheffield United. And of course, Burnley lost, this time a record 7th straight home game, 2-1 against West Ham. Fulham Wolves will be Monday evening. Let's begin with the City of Manchester's in-form side, United.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
It's Diogo Dalo who pulls the ball back across. Garnacho! That is outstanding! A spectacular goal from Alejandro Garnacho!
The sound of Rob Hawthorn and, of course, Gary Neville reacting to the opening goal from Sunday's clash between Everton and Man United. It finished 3-0 to Man United, of course. But we're going to begin with that incredible strike from Garnacho.
Yeah, one of those goals now in kind of modern Premier League folklore that I'd call a kind of WhatsApp group uniter, where everyone just puts one word, like sort of, you know, sort of bang, hit, pow, strike, maybe. and everyone just, yeah, as everyone watches it with a kind of 1 second delay, they all filter down through several groups. It was, I think, probably the best individual strike I've ever seen in the Premier League.
Really? In the Premier League, really?
Yeah, I think so, because long-range goals to me have an element of hit and hope. I'm not saying this was, there was no fortune to this at all, but to extend his body back in midair, the cross was behind him, well, quite
away. He gets up to as well. Yeah. Is amazing.
And when it then goes in the top right-hand corner, rather than kind of bouncing down or... It's a phenomenal, phenomenal strike. It reminded me a bit of Sebastian Coates' goal for Liverpool at QPR.
I was there, actually.
But that was... That was closer to goal.
And it was more of a scissor kick, I think, rather than another, like, rather
proper in terms of how high he got. Yeah. But yes.
Phenomenal. When he was able to articulate again, Gary Neville called it the greatest overhead kick he'd ever seen.
In terms of cleanest body shape, everything, I think it's probably,
I don't know if there's an Ibra one that stands out to
Ibra?
Me. Yeah, against? Ibra against England, I think.
The one from quite a way out.
Yeah. Also, I mean, let's go and have a look at Quagliarella's showreel, because there's some absolute stonkers in there. But this was amazing. The only thing you mentioned, where the luck played a part, and this is going to sound terrible, but given where Garnacho's other shots ended up, how much he actually aimed that.
Kids keep trying.
Yeah, I guess.
Mauro Bressan would be my shout for the greatest overhead kick.
Yeah, very nice.
Do you know there was one Djorkaeff scored? It wasn't so much a...
It was kind of side on for Inter against Vicenza, I think.
Yeah. Like early 97. Absolutely amazing
Good
goal.
Good knowledge, Charlie. Yeah, that was... I mean, it was aerial, but he doesn't get... It's not foot over your head in quite the same fashion.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen people... You know, the natural comparison is Rooney's, but I think everyone's in agreement. The Rooney against City 2011, but that was more shin, where it actually hit the point of connection. This is so clean. It is... Yeah,
Crouch Besiktas was clean as well. Remember that?
Yeah, that was really good.
That was again close, kind of closer
in. Closer in, but looked obviously.
But here, I think
mad.
What makes here as well what makes a good goal, like the better goal here as well. You can see like the clean arch. Everything's really clean that happens on the goal. So that's I think why for me it's outstanding right now.
It was amazing. United ended up scoring two more goals. One was a pen. The other one was a nice little dink from Martial after a lovely ball slipped through from Bruno Fernandes. They were terrifically efficient on their way to their fifth win from six in the Premier League, the game they didn't win being against Manchester City, which, you know, can happen. Mm. They are now top of the form table. What does this mean?
Well, they were already. I mean, it's a very strange thing even going into this game. I tell you what's quite telling, though. This 3-0 win takes them to zero goal difference. And I think if you're trying to understand, like, how is it Man U are now, you know, they're 6 points off top, they've picked up a lot of points, but how is it that the eye test kind of tells you they still don't look that convincing? And I think that kind of tells you. I'm pretty sure today was their first win by more than one goal of this season in the Premier League. And, you know, if you were being picky, you'd say the games in this run that they've won have been against opposition that they should beat. Mm. So I think, you know, and United went on a really good run last year. But again, there was always that nagging feeling. And in that run, they did actually beat City at home. But generally, it was... quite kind fixtures and they weren't always massively convincing. So this sounds a bit being down on a team who've won 5 out of 6, but I still feel, I don't know, they need a slightly clearer identity and to do this against better teams before it feels like it's a massive turnaround.
They do have two big games coming up. Galatasaray away midweek in the Champions League, lose that game and they're effectively out. And then at the weekend, they're away to Newcastle, who obviously look pretty good themselves this weekend with that 4-1 victory over Chelsea.
Yeah. Exactly. I think that will be telling. And also, and I mean, I guess even the fact that within this six-game run, they've had those two games against Copenhagen, one of which they lost, one of which they needed a penalty save in the last minute to win 1-0. So, yeah, I think there are a few reasons why it feels like, yes, that game, that Newcastle game, certainly could be very revealing.
Okay.
This season they've lost basically all four of their games against the better opposition in the league. So that's why this coming up game is very, very important, just to see whether they've actually made any progress. Because, you know, as you mentioned, within this run of games, there was two massive 3-0 defeats against good sides.
Yeah.
They looked absolutely useless.
Daniel had this extraordinary stat, which I think is no longer valid as of this Sunday, about them and Burnley, Daniel.
Yeah, and I mean, until Sunday, because they scored very early and held that leading at seven until the end. But before Sunday, they had led for a lower proportion of their Premier League games this season than Burnley, who are bottom. Mm. I mean, that does also say that Burnley throw away a lot of points from Leeds.
Mm. But they were one of the lowest for a while.
Yeah, 12.5% before Sunday of games they were leading. I mean, as a flip side, they have had Harry Maguire and Johnny Evans as a makeshift offensive pairing for most of this run. Rasmus Højlund still not scored a Premier League goal. They're finding a way to do it. I think sometimes, especially it happens with United, they win when not playing very well, and with certain teams and at certain points we interpret that as a compliment, and with some clubs we interpret it as a negative. And I can see why it happens with United, because I can see this falling apart quite quickly and everyone saying, you know, this is Manchester United, why are they playing like this? We've all been there before. But right now, they're the form team in the league on merit, and I'm used to watching them lose to some of the teams they're beating. Now, I honestly thought that Everton, given the atmosphere, which we'll talk about, I thought they might get, you know, rolled over today at Goodison.
Mm, yeah.
And they did the opposite.
How key was Garnacho's goal in not letting that happen?
Yeah, massive. Mainly in terms of simmering down that atmosphere at Goodison, which wasn't against United or even particularly pro-Everton. It was against a situation. But yeah, I suspected that United would probably fall down in that pressurised environment, and they played really well.
Top of the form table, sixth in the actual table. How many points are they behind Liverpool, Sash?
Four and six off the top of the league.
It's extraordinary. Everton, meanwhile, a big defeat for them, but they didn't actually perform that badly for most parts of the game.
Once again, this season, Everton play all right. Mm. And, you know, they get through stages where they don't finish any chances, and then through stages when they do. Today was one of the days when they kept on shooting straight at the keeper, basically.
Or whichever United player was standing on the line.
Yeah, or whichever one of three United players standing on the line, which is quite a lot of United players. So I think in terms of performance, it wasn't bad in terms of obviously where they find themselves in the league now, particularly given Luton's result. It's not great. But also, I think what would be disappointing is that they failed to sort of ride the feeling of emotion, because it really felt like a cup final today. But that Garnacho goal, I think, really put the spanner in the works.
Yeah, it was. I mean, looking at the XG at this point still being tidied up, I think, but I've seen between 2.5 and 2.73 for Everton. I mean, they created really good chances in this game. And, you know, that first half, it was, especially towards the end of the half, United were clinging on, and it was kind of chance after chance. But I agree. I mean, that first goal was so massive. Because I felt going into this, if I were a United fan, I'd be like, why have the Premier League done this now? It's just the worst timing for us. Like, Goodison is a tough place to go to the best of times.
Right.
But
Premier League notoriously got it in for every club.
Well, exactly.
Not just Everton, but also Man United. A quick word on Kobbie Mainoo, is it? Disappointingly, it's not Man U, even though you could.
No. Yeah, it's got like sort of PES 2009 version of Man U. Yeah. Fine.
Could I just say about Everton, about Goodison being a difficult place to go? It isn't really. Like, if you look at the results, I think the one.
No, but United have lost there a few times. Like, I know not last season.
I think conceptually you feel like Goodison is a horrible place to go, but if you actually look at the results, I think they won one game there all season.
Good Lord.
So it hasn't really been Fortress Goodison.
Mainoo, then. Mainoo. Everyone raving about him and his performance. Comfortably Man United's best player so far. One reaction?
I think quite often you get this. It happens with Manchester United, but it happens with all big clubs where they're after something fresh in midfield and they bring in a young player who hits the ground running and looks really good, partly because they run around quite a lot, partly because they're technically very proficient because they are breaking out of an elite academy. It's that ability to kind of ride that wave of goodwill that's coming your way from everyone around you in the team and everyone in the stands, I think. And yeah, he did do really well. I'm not sure he was United's best player, but yeah, he certainly got a maturity to him. I mean, he looks about 14 years old. It's depressing seeing him be really good on a football pitch.
What did he actually do?
Cleared one off the line.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think your question is valid, because I think that's the point. I think it's almost about an intensity and a mindset. I think sometimes we expect with young players they're going to get knocked off the ball, that they're going to get down when they make mistakes. He doesn't look like that. He looks like he's full of belief. The question is what happens a year down the line, because we've seen repeatedly at elite clubs young players coming in and looking really good, and then Everything else tends to settle down a little bit and they have this plateau, and it's what you do with the plateau. But yeah, he's clearly got bags of talent, and there's not a better place in Manchester United squad to be in than a central midfielder who, you know, is trying to make his way, because he should get a lot of minutes if he plays well.
More good news for Man United then. Bad news for Everton, of course, the fact that they are now 5 points adrift of safety following this 10-point penalty that they've been handed and are appealing. And, yeah, worth mentioning the reaction, the kind of coordinate, the choreographed response of the placards with the words Premier League corrupt on them, the flypast to the aeroplane at Manchester City on Saturday.
Also, there was a pre-game march, which I think people who were at the march reckoned the whole stadium went on the pre-game march.
Really?
From around nearby roads and around the ground. And which actually, I think, did deliver the best picture, I suppose, associated with this. And there was a guy walking down with this sort of thing placard.
Right, yeah. Probably Andy Burnham, who was there in his capacity as Everton season ticket holder. And he's actually written, I think he was saying, to the Premier League, demanding that they release their... the motivation.
Release the audio.
Well, I think he wants the papers. I mean, this is speculation. Oh, that's just not
any evidence that the Premier League discussed the fact that they're trying to avoid an independent regulator being brought in their decision as to what kind of penalty to hand Everton, which it's a valid talking point.
There's three reasons for that huge protest. One is it's transparent anger, it's exactly as it looks like. The second is that there is a benefit at a time like this to creating a siege mentality around a club that has been pushed into the relegation zone, to kind of say it's us against the world. The atmosphere at Goodison was, by all accounts, as good as it's ever been, and that's because of the protest. And the third is, by kicking up a stink, you hope to earn some goodwill amongst neutral voices and therefore push pressure on the Premier League to reduce your sentence to the 5 or 6 points that we probably expected. So it was within their interest. I think, look, if it had been any club, the reaction would have been exactly the same, because I think there's this kind of righteous fury about it. The thing that's really interesting to me is that kind of a few months ago, Fahad Moshiri was the bad guy and it was all like protesting against that mismanagement. And now it's almost like he's been able to escape the spotlight during Everton's worst days. He's been able to escape that spotlight because it's all been pushed onto the Premier League. I suspect he's pretty happy about that.
Mm. Well, see, I think that this is possibly my maybe ambivalence towards the Everton protest, is because Premier League did not mismanage Everton. It's Everton's ownership that mismanaged
Everton.
Sure,
but in a world in which a club that goes bankrupt gets a 9-point penalty, the 10-point, I think the magnitude, it's not, I don't think the protest is that there was no case to argue. It's just that the penalty does seem disproportionate, unless the Premier League are ready to come out and explain why it was so much more than people. So,
and I think this is where it's important for Premier League to improve its communication, shall we say, because so far, pretty much all that everyone's seen is the report. I mean, one thing that has been really irritating me, I haven't seen the breakdown of the FFP calculations. I mean, there are people like the Swiss Ramble out there who've done a detailed breakdown from the available numbers. But I also have questions about some of the numbers that they've come up with. Because, I mean, one thing I'm looking at is this 88 million that was written off for COVID, which is...
Well, I'm sure the Premier League would have had... I mean, they'll have had people examine these numbers. Not that...
I think the concept of writing off this 88 million when no one else in the league does. Villa did 13, no one else did anything.
Right.
So Everton's transfer strategy was unique in this particular way. I really struggle with this concept.
Okay. There's going to be a lot of opportunity, no doubt, to discuss the points and the penalty. For now, let's just say that, United next up will be taking on Newcastle, who were 4-1 winners against Chelsea on Saturday afternoon. Kind of redolent of the time they took PSG apart by the same scoreline, only this time they did it without, what, half a dozen of their starters?
Yeah. Going into this weekend, I looked at Tottenham and I looked at Newcastle. There's two of these clubs roughly in similar positions in the league with probably roughly the same ambitions this season. And they both feel like these games of buckaroo where you take off another really important player and you take out another cog in the system and you wait to see how long until everything implodes. And at Tottenham today, I think it was fine, and then Bentancur came off and he was the last one and it imploded. Newcastle, you seem to be able to do take off more and more and more each time, and they just stay as strong. They were very lucky to, I think that's the worst defensive display I've ever seen from a inverted commas big six team.
Thiago Silva.
Thiago Silva, but also Benoit Badiashile was at fault for literally probably two goals. Mark Cucurella kind of Mark Cucurella'd his way through the game and obviously got booked and now he's banned. Just nobody, Robert Sanchez doesn't seem to be able to suddenly deal with a free kick into the box or a corner. It's just, it's so broken.
And that bit where he fell over, kind of on his own, was a concern.
There are a number of times. there are times when you watch Chelsea and you think, okay, I can see sort of what's happening here. And then there are times when you watch them and think, like, what are you doing all week in training? Like, what did you think Newcastle were going to try and do to you? They're going to try and be really intense. They're going to press you in the ball with your centre-backs. They're going to try and get balls into the box and they're going to try and get Anthony Gordon running at Reece James. And they failed every task.
Well, Pochettino called it their worst performance of the season. But Newcastle, how has Eddie Howe been able to keep them ticking at this kind of level?
I think this is what Daniel mentioned there towards the end. Anthony Gordon, and the fact that the whole Chelsea right flank ended up being unprotected because they got Gordon running at them. And Joe Ellington is just this big force behind them, just sweeping everything up, pressing. So they effectively, I think, overwhelmed Thiago Silva and James, who were not really protected by their midfield at all. And if anything, at times, you end up with Chelsea Gordon watching, because I think that's pretty much what happens on the first goal. They completely forget about other players. Obviously, Gordon's cross for the second goal. And then the finish for the fourth from Gordon was just sublime. So I think there is a situation where I think Eddie Howe just found a weak point in Chelsea and they absolutely crumbled. And maybe this is, again, the absence of Caicedo. I mean, by the time Caicedo came on, you know, the game was over. And, you know, we'll get on to the South Americans flying from their games and, you know, the state they can be in. So obviously he couldn't play this game. And I think perhaps sometimes you need a midfielder to just react to what's happening around them. And that midfielder just wasn't there.
Mm. Another big thing for Newcastle, the fact that Alexander Isak is one of the players back from injury.
Lovely assist from the 17-year-old Lewis Miley. That was really nice disguise on that. And Cucurella, who Daniel mentioned, was playing him on side. Great finish. He is really important for them, obviously. And you know, they were missing both him and Wilson for a period. You know, they have had this run of injuries. And it'll be interesting now to see, you know, where they end up Europe-wise, because they could be still in the Champions League, they could drop down to the Europa League, or they could be out altogether. And I think any of those will have implications on their Premier League season, probably. Yeah. But Gordon's been brilliant. Really, really impressive. I think, you know, for them, they've been with that Barnes, which people kind of forget because he was there for such a short time before he got injured. But they do have some really exciting attacking players.
Very quickly, a shout out to Jamal Asell as well, who hadn't started a game all season until September. I think he started 5 games last season, 2 in the Premier League, and Newcastle lost both of those. He just was just nowhere. And as Sven Botman getting injured brought him in for the side. And he's since been in a defence that's beaten Man City, PSG, Arsenal and Chelsea. He's not a ball-playing central defender. He's not a Fabian Schär or a Sven Botman, but he's doing what he does exceptionally well at the moment. And I think he probably thought his career at Newcastle, Newcastle fans certainly thought that his career at Newcastle was over. But there's a number of defenders this season. Maguire's another obvious example who's just come back and done the basics well and suddenly their team has improved again.
He's a Forest. Start at Forest.
Purely coincidental.
Yeah. Well, the Sales and Company will be having a pretty interesting trip to the Parc des Princes on Tuesday to take on Paris Saint-Germain in the Champions League. Currently bottom of that group, but it's very, very tight. And then they got Man United at St. James's on Saturday. As for Chelsea, their next game is at home to Brighton. They'll be facing that without Reece James, who got sent off for a second bookable event after he picked up a yellow for kicking the ball away. They did get a nice free kick from Raheem Sterling, though.
So I was surprised to see him on free kicks. Like, I think it's... Does he take them now?
It was really weird, because as soon as it went, he clearly lined it up.
Yeah, it was him.
It was as if he'd been practicing all fortnight.
But have you, like, do you remember him taking a free kick in the Premier League
this
season?
I think he scored one other free kick in the Premier League.
Like, ever?
Yeah. So, it was really surprising.
Mm. And then his second half, having scored a free kick, he then gave Reece James one, who did nothing with it. And you think, you've just scored a free kick, mate. Take the next one.
He's probably got as many direct free kicks now as Cristiano Ronaldo in the Premier League. Possibly. Anyway, just to shout out the Totally Football Show European edition, which will be out first thing on Tuesday for you, looking ahead to Matchday 5 of the Champions League. Also out on Tuesday, Full Time Europe, which is the Athletic's women's football podcast. Next up, we're off to the Etihad.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
We're sponsored for this episode of The Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to The Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally.
Before you get back to this Athletic podcast, did you know it's just one of many made by The Athletic every week? I'm Abby Patterson, senior producer here at The Athletic, and I get to work across so many of our shows. But even I have my favourites. Sometimes you're just too busy for a full-length podcast. I get it. We've all been there. Well, we've got a show to help you. Get up to speed with all the football stories you need to know about with our daily football briefing.
It's done and dusted. Saudi Arabia will host the 2034 World Cup.
Got a bug for the women's game? Then Full-Time Europe is for you. It's our dedicated women's football podcast answering the questions you're asking from the WSL and Champions League.
So what's going wrong at Arsenal?
But perhaps you want to know exactly how a team has set itself up. Then come to the audio whiteboard and join Michael Cox and our analytics gurus as they dissect and examine the game like nobody else can. That's on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
I don't think I've ever seen a striker who reads the game so well.
Just search The Athletic wherever you're listening to this podcast now, and you'll find your next podcast obsession in no time at all. Now, let's get back to your show.
This is The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Diaz was looking for Gravenberg. Unintentionally, he finds Salah. And there's Alexander-Arnold, and it's 1-1. Liverpool have found a way. They were always in the game. Now they're level in the game.
Saturday lunchtime, Manchester City 1, Liverpool 1. A game that ranked 6 out of 7 on Saturday evening's match of the day.
Mm. It was no Forest Brighton, to be honest, so you know, it's only fair.
Right. How significant, though, was this draw for both sides?
I think it's more important for Liverpool than City, in a way, because obviously City lose the winning run, etc., and they were very disappointed after the game. But for Liverpool, I think a team where it's at the moment, to be able to go to the Etihad, where they never win, and get a draw like they did, come back from 1-0 down, not fold like they did in April, which I think is huge, huge difference. Midfield in April, when they got battered 4-1, was Henderson, Fabinho, Elliott. Midfield this time was Jones, McAllister, Szoboszlai. This is McAllister, who was massively jet-lagged and falling asleep in team talks. Right. And yet still, you know, they kept the shape in the first half. The goal was just an error. And in the second half, they stayed
the
in
goal from City.
The goal from City Alisson slipping over. And it's a thing which Klopp has, I think, an expression for it. They basically weren't ready to defend.
Right.
So you have a situation where they weren't ready to such an extent that Aki just went between
Szoboszlai. I mean, that was bad. Yeah, he sort of wandered through them. Yeah.
And then Alisson should still, I think, save it. So that was one bad moment. But overall, the content of that was pretty good, even though Klopp wasn't too happy with it because he didn't do much offensively in the first
half. How surprised, though, when you left the Etihad, how surprised were you? You were walking away with a point, Sash?
I don't think we're terribly surprised having seen the game. That's the thing. So it's just, when I was on the pod last time, I thought that this game would be hugely important in determining whether Liverpool can sustain a title challenge. Mm. Having walked away from that, I think in conjunction with winning games against the lower teams and looking at what the other teams are doing, yes, they're still very much in the title race and they can compete with City. I appreciate that City didn't have Stones, didn't have Grealish, didn't have Kevin De Bruyne, but conceptually, to stay within this game, to come away with a point from the Etihad, I think it's a big boost to what Klopp's doing.
Pep afterwards asked repeatedly about the second City goal, which was then ruled out because of a foul. Oh, go on then, Daniel.
It just wasn't... I mean, I know the whole thing about like the refereeing crisis is entirely like fueled by self-interest, but it was very funny to kind of see notorious Liverpool supporters that I follow sort of very much brushing over that very soft foul on given.
Do you think it was a soft foul?
I don't think it was a foul at all.
I think it was a foul because keeper's in the air. He goes through his shoulder. You look where the keeper ends up. He didn't end up in his net, well, over his goal line, in his goal by magic.
So from what I understand, these are the fouls that are always given. So in that sense, we shouldn't be surprised. But I did feel that Alisson had managed to miss catching the ball before the foul from Kanji.
He has his arm on his shoulder
right,
at the very, very moment. And
okay.
I think what Akanji does is very smart.
Right.
Because he's not that far away from Alisson, but he jumps with him, having no chance to play the ball. And arm on the shoulder, but also enough of a force to it to basically throw him off balance. I think that's a foul. Unfortunately, in the Premier League, we have seen stuff like, you know, remember when Willy Bolly basically assaulted Dubravka and the goal was given? And I was like, because there have been so many unbelievable calls in the past, I think basically affects what people think of this goal. But I honestly can't believe there's even discussion about this.
Charlie, you're in Stockley Park for us. What are you giving?
Yeah, good process. To be honest, it was one of those where I certainly didn't think it would be overturned once it was given as it was. I also don't think it would have been overturned the other way. It felt fairly marginal. Generally, goalkeepers are a protected species, and Sasha will say that's as it should be.
Scum, yeah.
Yeah, the kind of proper football man thing is just like they get, you know, you can't breathe on a goalkeeper. I think it's a marginal one.
Well,
I don't think it's glaring
either way.
They didn't
give it. And as a result, when Ron Gravenberch,
I don't know, whatever,
roamed upfield late on.
Good sub. It was good sub.
Well, I was going to say on the subs, I mean, I'm aware that I'm about to play the world's smallest violin, but you look at the squad depth of Manchester City versus Liverpool this season.
They had no attacking subs yesterday.
Yeah, they didn't. I mean, Liverpool brought on Luis Diaz, Gakpo, Gravenberch, Elliot and Endo. And could have brought on Gomez and Ibrahim Kanate if the game was different. City didn't make a sub. And normally that's, you know, everyone sort of wry smiles at Pep. But there wasn't anyone to bring on in that situation.
I was looking at the substitution.
Oscar Bob was the only attacking player there. And it would have made very little sense to bring him on, I think, in that situation.
This happens surprisingly often with City, though, because they do have a relatively small squad. They tend to pack it with sort of 16 and 17 really, really good players. And that's why it works so well. But then you get a couple of injuries. And it can, and especially if those injuries are in the same position, it can suddenly look they don't have.
They have also sold Cole Palmer, Riyad Mahrez, Gundogan, Sterling, Jesus, and Zinchenko since the start of last summer. So like they have really gone in on this.
Yeah.
And I know Grealish was ill, and Mateus Nunes had sustained an injury on international break.
De Bruyne is out.
De Bruyne is out. Suddenly that bench looks very different. Don't get me wrong, but I just suddenly thought with half an hour to go, I looked at the benches and thought
Scott Carson.
Yeah.
He's there.
Could come on as a striker. So you've done that before.
What a great job. Third choice keeper for City. It's a brilliant job.
Trent, it was anyway, who equalised after that fine run by Gravenberch. And then the final whistle, and we had the beef between Darwin and Pep. Has anyone come up with a conclusive? It looked as though Darwin was basically pointing at back at the goal where Trent had scored. Was that what? Sorry, Tash,
I definitely Darwin started something, but I don't think anyone has any idea what he started.
But I really want to know.
I know the way he was pointing, I don't know if it was certainly referring like it was saying like you did this back then.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was about that goal or that Pep had been too exuberant at another moment. Who knows?
I mean, he is an absolute agent of chaos, Darwin Nunes. I have to
even
say,
even in the dugout,
I fully accept that Liverpool fans walking out of the game will be happy with a point, but you really could have won it if, with Nunes, you get what you get in that he has more than five shots a game, which is, I think, like 1.3 on average, or higher than any other Premier League player. It's nonsense how many shots he gets to take. I think he's on 5.12 or something.
5.26 per 90.
Yeah, and nobody else has got more than like 3.9, I think, which is just ludicrous.
Wow.
But he doesn't, you know, he takes his shots from funny places. He misses the chances you think he's going to score. He scores the chances you think he's got no chance with. He is incredibly frustrating, but as a neutral, a fantastic player to watch. And I just think in those moments, Klopp must just be thinking, we can make him 5% more calm in front of goal. we can win the league because he the amount of chances he gets.
I think ironically yesterday there were situations where he should have shot and he didn't. So
yeah,
it's like
it's
a full gamut.
Whatever
he
does,
wasn't
there?
The whole thing often doesn't make sense. But I think he's already much improved on what he was last season.
Agreed.
If anything, his involvement in the general team play. If anything, yesterday he was less involved. Like, you know, only 14 passes, only 23 touches, which is kind of towards half of what he's usually involved in. I think one of the reasons for that, he was up against 4 centre backs. I mean, I think City now quite hard to play against. You know, quite hard even to count. Counter-attack, defensively, they're very, very good.
Really? Okay. Because I was just going to ask whether City do have a bit of a problem, that they're not controlling games the way they used to, whether the arrival of Jeremy Doku is this generation's Aspilia to Newcastle.
Nice. But City do this. Like, they'll always have... They remind me of like someone who, after every exam, would be like, oh, no, I've done terribly. Like, this is going to be the year. But then we'll obviously be fine. We'll work it out. Like, remember last season, as late as February, it was, you know, City, they've got a big problem. You know, they're not going to win the league. And I feel like they've always got this little issue and then Pep will work it out and
I don't think it's an issue. I actually think that Pep just makes it interesting for himself. What can we do this season? Last year, what can we do at home this year? What can we do with Doku?
So what's he doing this
season?
He wanted
this season, I think, to win via control, to kind of strangle games, to pursue three competitions deep with the energy levels reduced from last year.
Yeah, well, because that was what won them the treble, was going to that 4 centre-back model. It was amazing. And then now that's what you talk about. That's why they're so hard to play against now.
But one thing that was noticeable on Saturday morning was we used to go to the Etihad and there would be periods of suffocating pressure. You couldn't come out. They would just hem you in. It wasn't there on Saturday. I don't know whether it's a function of, you know, the injuries and or you know, the fact that they couldn't change things up. But I thought Bernardo was magnificent. Doku was very interesting. Not that maybe as good as some people have made out, but there was certainly something happening. But this great sense of being basically squashed into the ground just wasn't there.
Yeah, they do remind me of the best Ferguson's United teams in the way they pace themselves in the tight. Like, they know how to do that. Because often with Fergie's United, you around this time of year, you'd think like, it just doesn't quite seem right. But they would be kind of second half of the season. And you know, it's not as if they're a long way off top. They're, what, a point off?
Point, so, yeah.
Just on the subject of City, having mentioned this notion that the Premier League was sending a signal, as well as punishing Everton with their 10-point penalty, to what extent do you think City and possibly Chelsea are currently feeling very worried about the future?
I think they are feeling worried. I think it inevitably suggests precedent. The cases are very different. Everton were accused of rule breaking. City are accused of systematically cheating to avoid rule breaking. They're two different things, and they will be dealt with.
Doesn't sound a lot better though.
No, it absolutely doesn't. And if they are found guilty, the punishment will be many times greater than that. The difficulty is, it was very easy to prove Everton's guilt. With the City's case, it's all about proving the guilt, which is beyond a reasonable doubt very difficult. And look, the Premier League are now going to come under a huge amount of pressure for a verdict to be found in those cases.
The plane flying by the Etihad was a pretty interesting,
and from every other club,
choice.
I think, because at the moment there's a sense that the Premier League is, you know, PR-wise, is really struggling here. It's got three big questions with Everton, Chelsea and Manchester City, and they potentially affect top four and top six, the title and relegation. This needs to be sorted out quickly, but it isn't easy. They want this sorted out as efficiently as everybody else does, but it's not easy.
Just to give a bit of love to Trent, Alexander-Arnold, who I thought defended pretty well against Doku, not on his own, as he did in April. This time Szoboszlai helped, McAllister helped, I thought Matip was superb. But the way he took the goal was just, I mean, first of all, it was a brilliantly constructed move, and then Gravenberch makes the run to make the opening. First touch and second touch straight in. I mean, we were kind of right in front of it, the ball's coming towards us. The strike was so sweet. And then he went over to the City fans. I mean, I'm not sure whether he heard the chance of feed the Scousers, but, you know, the way and responded afterwards, you know, the Scouser and that team. So I think, I don't know whether he was making a point of the fact
he gave it the shush.
I don't know whether he's spoken after the game why he gave them the shush, because they could have just been generally just baracking him, you know, because he's the opposition right back and a star player. But it was a moment where I think a lot of Liverpool fans went, well, you know, fair play. This is a good moment for us.
Okay. Similar goal to the one, I think, scored by Ollie Watkins in Sunday afternoon's clash between Spurs and Villa.
Yeah, I mean, not dissimilar to Haaland's as one of the first.
No,
the
that's
way,
true.
Really good first touch out of his feet and then...
Better strike from Charles.
A better strike,
So Spurs losing against Villa sees Villa move past them into the top four. for the first time, Charlie, since 2009, after this long in the season. Is that right?
Yes, after 13 or more games.
Which sounds kind of significant. Arsenal, meanwhile, moving top of the table with a 1-0 win at Brentford, which is possibly less interesting. Should we talk about the game that you guys were both at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium? How impressive were Villa after a ropey first half?
I honestly can't tell. This is the first game that I've seen Spurs this season, and this is a huge compliment to Ange Postecoglou, where I've not thought what would have happened if Harry Kane was here. But it was impossible not to today. Spurs missed so many. I mean, they missed two golden chances in the first 4 minutes. It was exactly as we expected, which was two high lines, a lot of chaos, nobody really defending very well. I was more surprised with Villa for that, because Tottenham had a back four of four fullbacks, and they had two midfielders who, you know, feel like forgotten parts of an abandoned robot. They were just, you know, that's Brian Gill and Giovanni Lo Celso. Tottenham were incredibly makeshift and played in a makeshift manner because Bentancur went off and ruined that.
Yeah, I mean, Spurs played without a centre-back or a defensive midfielder, which, you know, was clearly a reflection of how they're missing a load of players.
And not an indictment of Eric Dier's.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Dier is not quick enough to play the way Ange wants to play. He wants to play the high line. Obviously, Villa play the high line as well. I agree with Dan. I mean, it was a weird game in some ways. I think Villa did what they needed to do. I think they rode their luck at times as well. Though I also think when you play an offside trap, we always kind of put an element of luck to that, which is maybe unfair because it is very well choreographed. It just seems such a high wire act whilst watching that you're kind of like, how are they confident enough to do it? But they kept doing it. Son had three goals disallowed for offside. And when they played each other in May, it was similar. Villa held a high line. I think that game broke the record for most offsides in a game by one team. And I think for Spurs, it's one of those things where they've lost three games in a row.
In each of those, they've taken the lead.
And they've taken the lead. So, you know, the way football is now, top-level football anyway, we feel duty-bound to say, is they're in a crisis, aren't they? I mean, they must be. They've lost three games. But I think everyone kind of understands with a little bit of context and knows that, you know, we always thought this would be a project and a process. You know, the whole thing with Postecoglou before the start of the season was, oh, it'll take a bit of time. They massively exceeded expectations. The thing everyone kept saying was they've got a good first 11, but their squad's quite thin. They've had a bunch of injuries. The squad's been exposed. But I don't think, you know, and today they could have played Eric Dier. They could have played Pierre-Emile Højbjerg to start. They did neither of those things. But they might well have lost doing that anyway. So I don't think there's not actually that much frustration, apart from the result. But the way they played was actually pretty good today, all given right. All the absences especially.
There's a set of supporters who very obviously, as soon as you go in the stadium, before and after even defeats, remember what this would have been like under the previous manager. And if Tottenham had had that sort of team out under Antonio Conte, they'd have kept men behind the ball. They wouldn't have tried to attack. They might have got a point. They might not have done. But it wouldn't have been enjoyable. And it was still enjoyable today. The fans did enjoy it. They created chances. Yes, they are flawed. And yes, they conceded a number of clear-cut chances. But it was fun. Mm. Villa are just too good to be done.
I mean, Villa fans can think about what this team would have been like under their previous manager.
Yeah, they'll do that fondly because they're just too good. They had too many parts that Tottenham didn't have today. They've got a magnificent back four, or two magnificent centre-backs. They've got really good energy in midfield that Tottenham just lacked. They've got a fabulous number nine striker who is, I mean, he was given space anyway, but I think he's one of the best he's in the top three in the country strikers at finding space around the penalty area now. And his finishing has been absolutely brilliant this season. Yeah.
I mean, one thing that links those two regimes is Matty Cash putting in pretty
Cash.
Nasty tackles on Spurs players. He did one on Matt Doherty that put him out for a while. He did one on Bentancur today. And I think he's lucky that, and you know, it's probably a good thing for Spurs that Romero wasn't on the pitch, because I think there would have been some retribution there, because he looked furious even when he wasn't playing. And you could see the Spurs players were absolutely raging, some of them. Bentancur coming back off an ACL. This is his first start for Spurs since February.
And how badly is he injured?
Well, it's his ankle, and it's too early to say at this point, but at least you know, it's
was there any particular reason for Cash going in? Was Bentancur running rings around him?
It was one of those where I think Bentancur was passing backwards and Cash comes flying in.
It was very quickly after the long VAR delay and disallowed goal, was it? So I wondered if, from memory, maybe it was a kind of frustrated reaction to that. But yeah, it was a pretty nasty challenge. Mm.
Emery took him off at half time basically for his own good, because he then fouled Udogi, and it was one of those where it was clearly one more and you're off. So again, smart management, and his subs worked really well. Tielemans came on, made the goal, made a difference. Playing in, you know, he's been playing this season in a kind of off the striker role, which we don't normally associate him with. But yeah, he made a vital contribution.
Villa are 2 points off the top, Sash. They are going to be hosting both Arsenal and Man City in the space of a week at the start of December.
Well, let's see what they can do with those free kicks, because I thought the free kick that they did today to equalise was actually brilliantly executed. I mean, again, insane high line, a lot of space. I think one of the things they took advantage of today, Vicari went to pieces, I think, after conceding that goal, because this is a thing that I find quite weird often. So he's out, obviously, high line. Vicario is on his penalty spot. The ball is coming towards the penalty spot. No, Vicario starts retreating backwards. And I just do not understand when keepers do that, because surely you can step 2 yards and just catch the ball just there. Instead, he's 6 yards off his line and, you know, he gets caught out by a very good header. And I think there was a few of those free kicks that Villa had today. And then he's just started fluffing chances the second half. I don't think he did very well for the goal. He nearly got lobbed. I mean, it's a function of how he plays.
There was that Bailey when he fumbled
onto the post. So I don't know. Was there anything specific that happened to you?
I don't know. I mean, it's his
same
first...
Same Emerson Royale.
Yes.
It's not always easy.
It's his first... I mean, he had a few shaky moments on his debut against Brentford. Since then, he's been so solid. Yeah,
it's the first game where he's been like this.
It's hard to know. He had an illness as well during the international break. But yeah, it wasn't his best day. I mean, Postecoglou talked about that as well in his press conference. The fact, you know, one of the downsides, there are probably a few, but playing four centre-backs did mean they were more vulnerable at set pieces. And obviously, so it proved. And I think that was such a crucial goal for Villa to score. Spurs put so much into that first half. They were pressing so high and so aggressively, and you just felt they needed to go in at half-time ahead.
Didn't happen. If it's goalkeepers not looking comfortable hereafter, then let's have a quick word about Arsenal's 1-0 win at Brentford. Kai Havertz, the hero, with the header in the 89th minute, which put them top of the table. At the other end, Aaron Ramsdale reacting to his rare opportunity in not the greatest of fashions.
Poor guy.
Yeah. Mm.
Poor guy. I think professional sport can be very, very cruel. And obviously, Arteta made his decision about the goalkeeping change. But I very rarely remember, I don't know, a goalkeeper taking it this badly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's that. So, I mean, I would say David Raya has played 12 times for Arsenal, but no game has furthered his cause more than yesterday.
That's cruel to say, but it's true. Actually, I think it's fair, yeah.
Until yesterday, I think there was still a school of like, oh, you know, I mean, I think most people realised Raya was the number one, but I think there was a school of like, but, you know, should he? What about Ramsdale? I think this, and you know, Arteta's done that. I think Postecoglou's doing that a bit with some of these players, is kind of saying, okay, here's your chance. Go and prove me wrong. Awkward was the word I used watching this game. It was genuinely quite awkward and uncomfortable to watch. But I think part of it is it's very relatable. The one where he threw the ball just kind of down into the ground. I think most people who've played football or any sport have had a moment where they're just so frazzled, they're in two minds. You know, be it taking a throw in or playing a simple pass, you get caught up and it's yips. But I think, yes, about taking it badly, but I do think Ramsdale... So much of it is because he's English, he's really likable, he's done quite a lot of media, so people feel like they know him, Arsenal fans love him. And so it's just, it feels a lot more relatable than a lot of these situations. For instance, you know, Ramsdale came in when Arteta did something similar with Bernd Leno.
Yeah.
No one cared about Bernd Leno's feelings.
I did.
Sash did.
No one else cared.
Yeah. But Ramsdale, you know, I think Arsenal fans especially are feeling this quite keenly.
Right.
And yesterday it was just so writ large.
Well, it took two goal line clearances from his teammates Rice and Zinchenko to prevent the day taking on a very different hue. But as it is, Arsenal are top of the table by 1 point as we move on to things down the other end next.
Hello, listeners. This is Ian Stone, host of Handbrake Off, your dedicated Arsenal podcast from The Athletic. Myself and Amy Lawrence, Adrian Clark, Art DeRoche and James Maniculus are with you twice a week, every week throughout the season, as we bring you all the news and views from in and around the club. Listen for free wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to follow and subscribe so you don't miss a single episode.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Football Content Awards International Podcast of the Year.
Down the bottom of the Premier League, Luton win, Bournemouth win again. Forest lost, so did Everton, Burnley, well, yeah. Let's talk about the Cherries, 3-1 winners away at Sheffield United. Ooh, that's their first away win of the season. Not long ago, it seemed like a matter of time before Andoni was going to be heading back to Spain. But now you feel probably the Cherry is going to be hanging on to him with increasingly tight grip.
Yeah, I mean, we did say at the time, I think it was because of the way the fixtures went. I think it was December the 5th was Bournemouth's first game of this season where they played a team they played last season that they'd beaten. So they had this horrible fixture run where they either had a promoted team or they had a team they'd lost or drawn to last year, and it was normally lost. And Iraola's point was always, when the fixture list gets better, my style will look better because I love playing these wingers that are really high up the pitch, that can stay high up the pitch, and then we can counter-attack teams and we can cause them problems. And that's exactly what they're doing right now. Marcus Tavernier looks great. Antoine Semenyo looks brilliant. Justin Kluivert was playing rather than out wide because they've got so many wingers. He was kind of playing as this number 10 off Solanke. They've still got David Brooks, and they've got Luis Sinisterra, and they've got Dango Ataro. They've got so many wingers, and it just fits Iraola, I think. I think there'll be a team that are fine this season because they'll beat the teams that they're better than, which is probably only three or four in the league, but that'll be enough.
They've also had a pretty huge boost with that Everton 10-point deduction. I mean, like, as cynical as that's that, but, you know, they're suddenly, you know, they're, what, 7 points clear of the relegation zone, and Everton, who I think would have been, you know, they were above them, and now Bournemouth suddenly look fairly comfortable.
Bournemouth had 23 shots, 11 on target, whereas the home fans had to wait until the 88th minute to see their side produce one of those.
Sheffield United are doing that thing which can happen, where if a team is in the relegation zone all season, they almost certainly will sack their manager at some point. It's kind of about when you sack your manager. And they drew against Everton when it looked bleak, the game before the September international break, which bought Heckingbottom some time. And then they beat Wolves and drew with Brighton immediately before the last international break, which again bought Heckingbottom some time. Because if you're going to sack a manager, it's generally in an international break. And then they've suffered really awful defeats as soon as the international break is over. And that is a really, really surefire way to go down, basically. Well,
they were booed off at the interval by their home fans. Good news for Heckingbottom and United is that they are facing Burnley next week. Burnley, who have they lost six games in a row, home and away?
Seven home games.
Seven at home, but I think it's also six in a row home.
Six or seven in a row. It's six in a row now.
Six in a row in total, but seven, the last seven at home. Yeah. Which is makes them only the second team in English league history to do that.
Another former tough place to go.
Yeah, exactly. So does the manager who loses that game get sacked finally? I mean, it's crazy that this season no one's been sacked.
But why would you sack Vincent Kompany if you're heading to the Championship where he's proved himself incredibly
That is absolutely fair.
The Daniel Farker reason for syndrome. Maintaining employment, yeah.
Well, they were leading brutally right until the 86th minute. I mean, you know,
some great goals this weekend, but the Thomas Suchek volley with which the Hammers actually ended up taking all 3 points was magnificent.
Yeah, Thomas Suchek, who is on a phenomenal run of scoring late goals. He scored an 88th minute winner for West Ham against Forest before the international break. He scored a 90th minute goal for the Czech Republic against Moldova during the international break. And now he scored a 90th minute winner for West Ham at Burnley after the international break. The interesting thing about West Ham, very quickly, is Divin Mbama is their superstar academy forward and is out of contract at the end of the season and has not signed a new deal because he wants minutes and was left on the bench for Danny Ings at the weekend, which caused some unease amongst West Ham fans, shall we say. And he eventually came on for Ings when they were 1-0 down after 62, 63 minutes and looked really bright, and West Ham won the game. So,
and forced the own goal, didn't
yes,
he?
I mean,
yeah. Like it was his goal at first.
And hopefully that means he gets to start now. Bowen and Antonio are both injured.
Let's give also a shout to Kudus, because I think it's both his crosses that actually forced the goals. And
well, very nice.
Kudus. I'm going to resist. Kudus,
yeah, there you go. All right. Kudus also to Luton, who picked up their first ever Premier League win at Kenilworth Road. This was 2-1 against Crystal Palace. And one of the, well, the Crystal Palace goal, Michael Olise's stunner.
Fabulous run here by Olise. Back on his left side. Oh, my goodness. Quality with a capital Q. Yeah.
So we've seen some pretty special goals this weekend. Where does this one rank? And can you describe it? Can you paint a little picture?
Well, he goes on a kind of dribble up the touchline, beats a few players, and then cuts inside and bends one into top corner. It's a brilliant goal. Probably the second best after Garnacho the weekend.
Actually, I think that's this is the thing, because his run is so long. You think he's beating a few players. It's the same player, but he's beating a few times. So he went from the halfway line to scoring the goal. Just past one guy.
Just keeps beating it.
Yeah, just past one guy. But what an astonishing finish. But then again, it's the first one he scored in 10 months.
Since that free kick against United.
Another lucky goal.
Yeah, in January.
Yeah.
He's been injured, of course.
But, well, I mean, again, we're talking about with Newcastle and Spurs and the frustration with injuries. I mean, how mad it must be for Palace that you finally get Elise back and then you lose Eze. I mean, a lot of things maddening. I think also going to Luton and continuing to play in a pretty conservative way is also annoying Crystal Palace fans.
But also losing two players to injury. I mean, Eze got kicked, which I thought was a bit harsh again. I think he was coming back from injury.
Yeah.
And then Doucouré, ACL.
That sounds like Roy Hodgson-Southgate game. Like, it's not going to be a short one. It's going to be months. And he was probably their player of the season last year.
And big rumours in the summer, of course, about him leaving and stuff.
Yeah, they lose a couple to AFCON as well in January and February. I know I will go there. So,
do you fear for them?
Are we going to lose you to AFCON, Daniel?
Oh, yes, I hope so. Provisionally, yeah, for 10 days in the knockout for quarterfinals onwards.
Where is it?
Ivory Coast.
Ivory Coast.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. There you go. For as it stands, I've just checked the table. Where are Crystal Palace? They're 13th. They're quite away.
That's where they usually are.
They're always 13th, yeah, so that's fine, yeah.
13th, that's 10 points clear.
What will happen now is that Palace will lose 8 of their next 10 games and still be 13th, because that's what always happens.
I think they can be below 15th, surely, after that.
Not 13th, but only just not 13th. In 14th place are Nottingham Forest, who were beaten 3-2 by Brighton on Saturday. Seagulls coming from behind, who secure their first win in 7 league matches. What happened?
Well, if you want to beat Forest, that's the way to do it. They have lost 3 league games 3-2 this season, and they've had 1-0 lead in one of them, 2-1 lead in another, and a 2-0 lead in the third. So they are very, very poor at holding on to lead.
3-2 defeat specialists.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, if you were going to have a niche. I think it should also be said that if Forest don't beat Everton at home next weekend, I think Steve Cooper might well lose his job. There are kind of murmurings. I know that Mike Keegan at the Mail had a story about him being seriously under pressure. It sort of felt like Steve Cooper's been under pressure ever since Forest got promoted, but yeah, they do not want to be where they are now.
Whose long shadow is looming from somewhere else?
My semi-educated guess would be Julian Lopetegui, who's been living in the Midlands for the last X number of months, and I think...
And why would he be doing that, if not for the Forest job?
If not for a job, and I don't think he's getting Villa, so...
He's not getting Leicester, is he?
No. I think he would be the kind of obvious candidate, which inevitably then leads to some January spending and a good big old transfer list at the City Ground, and everything feels like normal again.
Excellent. Well, that's good, and well done to Brighton. Well done to Brighton. Actually, won 3-2. And was this better from the Seagulls? I mean, I'm basing this on
they scored some really nice goals,
right. Gorgeous goals.
Yeah, and De Zerbi celebrations are kind of worth watching.
I mean, Ferguson's
goal, fantastic. Yeah, very nervous. I mean, going down to men for, I think it was a double descent from Lewis Dunk.
Mm.
I think with Brighton, they've really missed a Stupinian. And this game as well, Mitoma wasn't there. I mean, obviously they managed to win the game, but I think Estupinian's absence, I think Estupinian and Mitoma on the left-hand side were pretty lethal, and they could defend as well. And once Estupinian's out, it's just the structure. I don't think they've managed to find a proper left-back replacement. I mean, this game, left-back replacement, Lamptey got injured again. So, yeah, so we'll see. I mean, what's rumours with Estupinian coming back? He is close, no?
I don't know. I mean,
because he was a month initially, month's gone.
Yeah, but De Zerbi then gave some comments. I don't know if these are his most recent comments, saying they weren't sure when he'd be back. But I agree. I mean, he is a great player. And they've obviously got Europe to manage this season
managing
as well.
Well.
They are, yeah. I mean, they've, you know, in that bad run, they've beaten Ajax
Marseille
twice.
They're home to Marseille.
They're home to Marseille. Oof.
No, that's not until... That's
oh,
not
I'm looking at the calendar wrong, aren't I? Yeah, you're absolutely right. They go to Athens.
They're going to Athens.
Yeah, okay. That's big.
And then
big
Chelsea
game.
Away. The Graham Potter derby.
The everybody does.
Well, and yeah. And all the players and execs.
There you go. Well, that's kind of it then for Match Day 13. There is still Fulham Wolves to come on Monday evening. And then that big, busy European midweek gets underway with key games from the Premier League's point of view, in particular Newcastle and Manchester United. As mentioned, Tuesday, well, actually on Monday late, possibly the European Totally Football Show will be with you. With thoughts on those matches and what happened this weekend on the continent. And then Thursday, we'll be back to review it all. Do join us. Listen, have a super time in the meanwhile. Thank you for being with us today. Thank you also to Sasha, to Charlie, to Daniel. Lovely to see you, to producer Charlie. And from all of us here, in fact, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.